From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, we have an interview with the poet A.E. Hines, who has been on the show once before when I spoke to him, as well as the editor, Erica Nichols Fraser, about the anthology A Tether to This World, in which his work appeared. A.E. Hines grew up in rural North Carolina and currently resides in Portland, Oregon. His poetry has been widely published in anthologies and literary journals, including I-70 Review, Sycamore Review, Tar River Poetry, Potomac Review, Atlanta Review, Crosswinds Poetry Journal, and Crab Creek Review. He is the winner of the Red Wheelbarrow Prize and a finalist for the Montreal International Poetry Prize. His new collection is Any Dumb Animal, published by Main Street Rag. Our conversation begins with his reading a poem from the new collection, My Father's Son.
My Father's Son. If my father was ever tender, I don't remember. By the time I could forge memories, he'd grown hard, cold, like the hood of his Pontiac on a January morning. Surely he must have changed my diaper or offered me a bottle when my mother's milk ran dry, held me when I cried. Biology has blessed us with the strongest recollection for what to avoid. So I don't know if he ever lifted my little body to the sky or carried me on his shoulders. Instead, I'm left with random sensations. The burn of the electric fence on my uncle's farm. How my father told me to grab hold of the naked wire so that I might remember, he said, so that I could learn. I can still make out my uncle's orchard, the sun glinting off the silver leaves, but not the first time I crushed a grape between my teeth or tasted the juices straight from my fingers. Perhaps there's simply too much good to remember, too little space in our brains to hold both the good and bad. When I was 16, overtaken by desire, I first understood what my father thought of me. He said the saddest son of a bitch he ever knew lived out in the woods with a daughter who longed to be a son, and a son who chased every boy in town. It was the same year he left our family, the year I discovered in his belongings a picture he had taken of me when I was 4. All cherub smile, the sun ablaze in my hair, a photo he must have treasured since he said he'd kill me before he let me have it. Which is really something when you think about it. The memory of the boy he had seen through the lens, so much better than the real thing standing right there before him.
Thank you for reading that. That was A.E. Hines reading My Father's Son from his new collection, Any Dumb Animal. It's funny, that first line, if my father was ever tender, I don't remember. That really, I read that a number of times because I thought it was a very engaging beginning. First of all, because of the emotional resonance of what that means. But also, you know, you have a near rhyme and it's just a kind of statement of sad fact, right? So I wonder if you remember writing that. Did that start at the beginning of writing this poem? Was that the beginning of your process of working on this? And also, just if we can talk a little bit about first lines and what you enjoy about a poem's first line.
That's great. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. This is one of those very rare beasts of a poem for me. Most poems I write, and I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I mean, I usually write, you know, the first lines are usually what come to me. And then I rewrite the entire thing 1,000 times and nothing remains that started right? I just sort of plug along. I think a lot of writers do that, looking for that. Why am I writing this? What's the message? Why do I not let go of whatever this topic is as I discover that topic? In this case, this was one of those rare animals where the poem mostly arrived. Obviously I did a lot of revision, but it arrived. And I think the first line persisted. It literally was there. And it was a meditation, really, this poem on memory as much of anything. I mean, this whole collection is really based on my kind of growing up and coming out in the South. And it's about a very difficult relationship with my father. In fact, it kind of explores my relationship with men, not only the men that I'm, you know, dating romantically over my life, but my future partners and spouses going through a divorce, my own relationship with my son raising as a father. Mm-hmm. And so in reflecting on sort of that as a whole, this poem kind of became sort of emblematic for me of the collection, in that it's sort of a wink and a nod to the fact that memory is fallible. And I wanted to be compassionate towards my father, even though there was a lot of really tough truths in the book about our relationship. And so I started searching my memory for, well, there must have been moments of tenderness. I mean, he fed me, he clothed me, I didn't die, right? I survived. But there were so many moments that were tougher. You know, I sort of, this exploration of memory, in that, you know, we tend to sort of, you know, biology has, you know, helped us evolve and survive by remembering what we should really get away from,
right,
and what's not okay. And so it's sort of an acknowledgement too, that memory is fallible, and that there must be more good in there than I can realize, or that I necessarily can lay hands to. But
that's really interesting, because you are getting all of that in that first line. You know, the "I don't remember" tells us that this is going to be a poem about memory. And then "If my father was ever tender," which precedes it, is telling us that this is the memory you're trying. I just think as a first line, it works really, really well for the whole rest of the poem.
Well, and it's the triggering, you know, the title came last, and I realized that the speaker of the poem at the end, the title often for me comes last. I write a title and it almost never lasts. But I realized that the title was really about this sort of like you looking at yourself outside of yourself. It was this kid that was in that picture. It was everything a father hopes his son will be when his son is this pretty little plaything, when he's a young starting out and he's an early father himself. And there's that son, and then there's the son that actually was. And I think that's what the discovery in the poem for me was that's what it's really about. And the triggering subject was the first line, was, hey, what he must have been, you know, and it just kind of unfolded from there. But then again, that's pretty rare for me. But first lines for me, often the first line, even though it may not end up at the first line in a poem, that impetus, that trigger, that reason for speaking ends up usually in the poem somewhere. Mm-hmm. It may be revised, but it ends up in there somewhere, because that's usually why I start questioning why I feel like I need to write.
Right. Do you usually tell a story in a poem, or are some of your poems just kind of observational, or I don't know, going off in some unexpected direction?
Yeah, I started out meaning I've not been a poet more than, I mean, I've only been writing poetry about 7 years. And this is my first book, but I always wanted to write fiction. So I always wanted to tell stories, you know, and I come from, you know, I'm from the South and we love telling stories, right?
Where are you from again?
North Carolina, okay. Originally. And a lot of the book takes place in North Carolina. So I prefer narrative style poetry. It seems to be I enjoy poems that actually, you know, take you on a little journey and have some, you know, characters in them. But occasionally I will write. I'm experimenting more now with the sonnet form and just, you know, letting myself meander more, because this book is heavy and I wanted to kind of take a break from just sort of the autobiographical. And honestly, I'm trying to take a break from trying, you know, it's really easy to write yourself as the hero in your own work if you're writing, you know, from fact. And so I'm trying to allow myself not to be the hero. And so,
which is more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm trying persona. So I'm still telling stories, but I'm just trying to find different departure points into the poems.
Do you think that formal poetry almost in some ways by framing it offers more opportunity for creativity?
When you say formal, do you mean
like a sonnet? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't read Diane Seuss's book, Frank Sonnets, I just read it. And there's a great line, and I'll paraphrase it probably wrong, but she says, and she has a line break in the exact perfect place, and she says, poverty, like the sonnet, teaches you what you can do, line break, without. And I know, that's so brilliant, right? Yeah. It's like poverty, the sonnet like poverty, I think is the line, you know, teaches you what you can do. And without. And so you get that double meaning. And that's one of the things I love about poetry is you can, when you find that magical place to break a line, right? So I do think, to your question, I do think that when you get put constraint, any kind of formal constraint, it does allow you to experiment what you can do and what you can do without. And that's good for me because I tend to be, you know, overly verbose, you know. I use words as if I get paid $1 to use them, which is sort of the antithesis of poetry, you know. And so that's actually one of the things I think it draws me to it.
Yeah.
But I'm not a formalist in any way. I've not been very successful at writing, you know, strict form at all. I'm not much of a rule follower.
Okay.
It's one of the things I keep challenging myself to do. Maybe I'll get to it. So the sonnet, just you know, sort of trying to combine, sort of forcing myself into a certain number of beats and maybe 14 lines is about as strict as I've learned to be with myself thus far.
Okay, great. There's a second poem, but I have a couple more things about this poem. So I love this line about I'm not getting the line right, but the line finishes, too little space in our brains to hold both the good and bad. And that made me think about what we remember and what we gravitate towards. But also, you know, is poetry most often inspired by the bad? I mean, even when we celebrate the good, is it because there is the bad to hold it up against? I don't know. I have to read more Mary Oliver to figure that out.
Yeah. No, I think, and it's sort of a, you know, there's something sort of Eastern philosophy in there, right? There is no good without the bad, right? There is no right without the left. You know, you talk about politics. Oh, God. So it's like, you know, you can't. There's a great Vietnamese teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who says if you're on the, you know, left ideology, you should not wish for the, you know, elimination of the right ideology, because without the right, there is no left. And so we live in this world of relatives. And I think, you know, I struggle with this, too, because, you know, my husband is I got married in 2020.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, thank you. I know in the middle of the pandemic and, you know, but a lot of this book focuses on a divorce after being married to another man for 20 years. And although it does kind of speak to the romance and the remarriage and the new partner in the book. And my husband was like, he's like, I think you should write a happy book next time. This one's kind of heavy, you know? And he said, so this book, what would you say it's about? And I said, oh, it's about relationships between my mother and my father and my ex-husband and you and my son. He said, what will the next book be about? And I said, well, it'll probably be about, you know, relationships with my father and my mother. So it's interesting. I think poets, you know, they speak to the important, and I'll get this wrong, whoever said it, but the idea of like a poet speaks when they cannot not speak, right? It's like they have to give utterance. And it's true for artists in general. And so there's a lot of dark against the light. And people actually reach out to poetry, I think, a lot when they're suffering. I mean, I certainly did going through traumatic times in my life and trying times. That's when poetry seems to speak to us the best. Now, that said, I mean, my God, love poetry and the wonderful things that, you know, we celebrate in poetry. Mm-hmm. Also fantastic. But without, you know, I mean, I had someone say one time, it's like, I don't understand why you poets are so obsessed with death. And I'm like, ah, well, that's sort of the us ultimate juxtaposition, right?
Right. Yeah.
Life, death, you know, it's what we all wonder about it. We all, you know, it nags us.
I remember reading or hearing, I can't remember, an interview with Antonia Nelson, who's a mostly a short story writer. And she was talking about in fiction how, you know, there tend to be, you know, you can kind of lump fiction into the kind that's an escape, and you can also put it into the kind that makes you feel a sort of universal understanding, which may not be as happy ending oriented, right? And I thought that was interesting because, you know, so often when you read fiction, maybe in a book group or with, you know, talking with friends, you'll hear, well, I didn't like the ending. It made me sad. It was an unhappy ending, right? You never hear that about poetry. Nobody ever says that about poetry. Like the people that want happy endings, I don't know, maybe they just know which poets to pick, but they're not necessarily looking for happy endings in their poetry.
Some of the poets, you know, I think Ron Padgett's a really good example of this. There's a lot of poets. John Brim, one of my mentors, they bring the reality of life into the word, right? But they make it funny, right? Because there's a lot of really sad things that are funny,
right?
Right. And so I think the fact that, if you know, poetry can also, certain poets are really good at making you laugh at ourselves, at yourself collectively, right?
Right. Yeah. So. Earl, I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading a second poem now, Bohemian Rhapsody, 1991.
I would love to. And this poem has an epigraph. It's a very short snippet from the lyrics of the song that the poem is titled after. Bohemian Rhapsody, 1991. Mama, life had just begun. Queen. When Freddie Mercury was sweating out the fever, fire burning up his blood, I was 21, still in college, and dancing in a back alley bar, a place with no street number, no name, a place hidden behind a steel reinforced door, so the bigots of Carolina wouldn't send us all up in flames. The boy pulling me to the floor, big torch of a man, pulled off his shirt to brandish his Navy tattoos, then placed my quaking hand on the sweaty vault of muscle and skin that shielded the base of his throbbing heart. Over Mercury's yell, he spat the news in my ear, said he had it too, the fire in his blood. Asked if I cared, asked if we could both burn up together. News we all feared, expected. Freddie Mercury singing out the last lines, his voice vibrating in our chests, his words pouring out our drunken throats. We college boys and midshipmen, we married men, our wives missing us at home. All of us burning up together in that back alley bar, each one sure Beelzebub did indeed have a devil put aside just for him, that we'd all be dead by fall, that nothing anymore really mattered.
Thank you very much. That poem. And, you know, part of it is, I think part of it is that I lived through that time period. I know that music. I lost friends to AIDS. It's incredible that we're so far past that time period. I'm not saying we're past AIDS, but it's a very evocative poem of a certain period in time. And the use of the fire, it was just really interesting to me. The fire is used in so many ways. There's passion. There's you know, the terminology of hell and what the bigots think is going to happen to the people in that room, in that bar. And then there's also like the spirit and energy of Freddie Mercury and of the people dancing. This was really, really, I just kept reading this. So the first stanza sets the stage for the time period and your own life and what you were up against as a gay man and what Freddie and all gay men were up against in larger ways. How much did you feel like this poem had to take on a certain amount of or any of your poetry, like how much do you feel like you have to speak for a segment of the population or a generation of men or women, you know?
That's an interesting question. On some level, I don't feel entitled to speak for anybody. Sometimes not even me. And so if I think about that too much, I might censor. What I write. I realize, you know, for me, it really comes from my own personal experience. I mean, I was raised so evangelical, and coming out at that time, you know, we did. I mean, I just based on at that point, AIDS was a known thing. People were dying around us, and there was very little treatment at the time. Things have changed so much since then, obviously, but it was formative for me because I was a new young adult. I was coming of age. I was coming out, and I had to make the decision to do that in spite of the fact that it might mean, you know, danger, in spite of the fact that it might, you know, from other people, the fact that it might mean death. And I realized that, and I talk about this, and I will get back to your question. I talk about this in another poem where I say, you know, it was that or die, you know, so it was like come out or die. And so that's what it came down to me for me. So I try to speak just for that. And I try to be careful not to speak for other people, although clearly here there was a certain level of feeling a part of a group.
Right.
And in some regards, the speaker of the poem is representing that group. I mean, he's identifying himself with, you know, the midshipman who's at that point closeted in the military. Sure. And the men who are sneaking away from marriages to be there, all of which, you know, I did experience at that time. It was very common at that time, particularly where I was in the South. But also identifying with the Mercury and with, you know, what we were going through. I mean, that particular Mercury died in 1991. And, you know, this was an example of where, you know, I wasn't trying to really make a statement about HIV. I mean, I literally think I had just seen the movie where Rami Malek stars as Freddie Mercury. And I often do this. I go, wow, you know, first of all, that was such a formative time in my own, you know, youth. That I go, what was I doing then? Where was I? And then I remember, yeah, oh, I know where I was. I know, yeah, exactly where I was. And that's where the poem came from. But unlike the earlier poem I read and we talked about, this poem went through like, it took 2 or 3 years to write this poem. I didn't know what this poem was about. And it meandered around until finally it ended up kind of becoming embodied around the lyrics to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And now how those lyrics applied.
It's funny to ask I feel like this is a personal question, but on the other hand, there's a lot of personal material here.
Yeah.
But do you feel like this is a recollection of a happy time? We were talking before about the good and the bad. Yeah,
that's a great question. This is one of those examples we were talking about earlier where it's a really alive time. So it's filled with both the good, the happy, and the sad. And it's alive and it's vibrating and it's dancing this moment. And that's what that moment felt like. That time in my life, you know, was like that. It was exhilarating. It was this idea of, it was sort of the same thing the speaker says to the midshipman says to the speaker in the poem, which is, you know, it's like, let's burn up together. What does that really mean? Right. It means a lot of different things.
Yeah.
But it was like, we're alive right now. Right. We're right. Let's be alive. And so there's something about the threat of death that, you know, or, you know, ostracization from your, you know, from the society as a whole that can make you feel both threatened and afraid. But when you embrace it, can make you feel very alive
and free. Right.
And free. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of what we were saying before about the good and the bad, something to rub up against so that they each have their meaning, you know? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that last line. That nothing anymore really mattered. And I loved that you were able to embody his song without using his words. I wondered to what extent was that the way you preferred to present those words in your poem? Is there some sort of like concern about using words in a song and not getting permission? I mean, I'm sure that's always on our minds.
Yeah.
It was perfect. I thought that it was perfect how it comes out, but I'm just curious about your thinking.
So I think what you're noticing is that the fact that I mentioned the nothing anymore really mattered is not exactly, it's paraphrased from the song.
Correct, right.
So I it's funny. I had this poem. This poem was published by South Florida Poetry Journal last year, and they nominated it for Best of the Net. And I thought, oh, good. Oh, and people respond really well to this poem. So, but this poem got rejected forever. It got rejected by journal after journal. And I literally had one editor send me back a note that said, I really would prefer it if you, you know, directly use the language from the song at the end, because that's what I, you know, that song is so iconic. So I thought on one hand, it was astute that the editor noticed that it was different, which is, I think it was astute that you noticed it was different, but I wrote it the way it came to me.
Okay.
And, later I realized that, you know, I knew that was sort of like, I knew how the song, you know, the song ends very iconically, right? That very famous, you know,
yeah, and he repeats it. Yeah.
Nothing anymore. And I think it's at all is the last.
Nothing really matters at all. Right.
At all. Yeah. And so I wanted to nod to the end of the song to bring us back to the title of the poem, but I didn't want to copy it exactly. And I didn't even consciously make that decision. I wrote it the way it was. And it was really funny. It would have been easy for me to take the editor's feedback and fix it to match it. I wasn't as concerned about, and I'm pretty sure, you know, if I get a letter from Queen, I will be thrilled. you know, for quoting the few words in the.
Sadly, it would not be from Queen. It would be from the lawyer of some estate.
It would not be. Yeah, yeah. I felt like Freddie would approve. But anyway, I did it unconsciously, and then I decided to stick with it because the words, they had now become my words, right? I had sort of heard. That's sort of what you talk about passing a torch. I mean, there's a big torch in this poem. That's what it felt like. It felt like that was kind of a torch in some regards. And I'm thinking about this just now, you know, the poem was kind of like a torch handed to me from those men in that bar, from Freddie Mercury, from Queen, from that time in my life. And then you carry it on. And, you know, and so the fact that the words weren't exactly what the lyric was, but nodded to the lyric, seemed to be appropriate to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think it's great. I didn't think at all you should have used the original lyric. And not because of the litigation concerns, although, you know, that's a concern. But I just thought it was perfect. All right. So we started out talking about the beginnings of poems. Let's just finish up by talking about the endings of poems. Like, when you read a poem that makes you go, what exactly is happening there? Or is it not always this? It must probably not always be the same thing. But is there anything that you can think of that you just really love about the ending of a poem?
Love them. I hate them. They're so hard. I can't remember who said it, but someone said anybody can start a poem, but it takes a poet to get out of one.
I love that.
Yeah, they're never finished. And so that's kind of what this poem, that's what's so interesting. We were just talking about the last lines of this poem. That's probably why it got rewritten so many times. I just didn't know where it was going, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was really about. And so I think, I mean, my favorite, I'll just tell you what I love. I love it when a poem, you know, cracks open into different potential meanings and create sort of a launching when the ending of the poem is the beginning for the reader.
Mm.
Right. So that when I read a poem and I'm still thinking about it, it's because I was hooked early enough in the poem. And then I went on a journey that was, you know, had sufficient number of surprises and turns in it and, you know, some level of illumination into trying to feel what the speaker was feeling. And then I start applying it to my own life beyond, right, the ending. And so my teacher, Dorian Locks, said to me recently, she said, yeah, you know, poems shouldn't, they should ask questions, they shouldn't answer them. So I like it when you get to an end of a poem and there's potential, some ambiguity around, what am I supposed to take from that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because then that allows the reader to apply it to their own life in a way that, you know, makes the poem unique and makes an infinite number of poems equal to the number of readers
I think your poem does what you're saying as far as a new beginning, or at least looking forward. You know, we'd all be dead by fall. Well, fall is in the future, and it just makes us think about what the future held for these men, you know, and what happened next or didn't.
Right.
Well, that's great. Well, Earl, thank you so much for speaking with me. I want to just mention again that your new collection is Any Dumb Animal. It's out now from Main Street Rag, and I've been speaking with A.E. Hines, the author of these poems. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with A.E. Hines. You can learn more about his work at aehines.net. And you can hear an earlier conversation that we had at writethebook.podbean.com. My prompt for the week comes from A.E. Hines and touches on something we discussed during the interview you just heard. Write a poem that explores duality by comparing and contrasting two topics that are generally considered opposites. For example, where is the light in the darkness? Or pick one or multiple things that are considered hard and describe them as soft. Describe a moment of gratitude in the midst of grief, or love that led to great loss. Again, it doesn't matter where you start, just pick a pair of opposing ideas and brainstorm a list of comparisons. Then arrange them into a poem and see where this experiment takes you. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.